Movers, shakers, makers. What makes creative people tick, and how do they find and develop their inspiration? Welcome to the podcast that draws back the curtain on the inventive mind and its artistic process. I'm Emma Lister. Alice Williamson is a difficult artist to categorize. Throughout her career, she has mixed movement with design, photography, fashion, and film. Recently, she was an artist in residence at Harvard University's Art Lab with collaborator Dr. Merritt Moore, exploring the possibility of a human and robot pas de deux. As a photographer, she's worked for Freed of London, and her work has also been featured in Vogue Italia. She has directed a film for the South Bank Center, a music video for artist Anna Silvera, and she's designed for a pretty ubiquitous toy company. She runs a successful dancewear company as well, designed by Alice, and is an accomplished seamstress. She made the costumes for Makeshift Company's first full-length piece, Insomniac's Fable. All this has been parallel to a career as a ballet dancer in some of the most prestigious ballet companies in the world, Hong Kong Ballet, Northern Ballet, and Staatsoper Ballet, Berlin. She is always making stuff. The day of our pre-interview, she'd bought 1 kilo of clay and was teaching herself how to hand-mold vases. Another time we had met, she had just completed a wooden puppet-making course. I asked her, was she always like this as a child, drawing, doodling, making things, or whether she had taken lessons?
Yeah, I was perpetually making things. Like, I don't, when I look back at my memories, they all just involve making. I mean, I remember being aware that I was making an obscene amount of time. Like, I was always in the car, I was picking up like little wrappers to like twist into little dolls, or I was very into geishas at some point. My grandparents have been to Japan, so I was like turning a lot of sweets into little Japanese figures. Yeah, I was always making worlds out of cement, flowers, flotsam. And then I remember my mum was more tolerant, but my granny got a little bit annoyed about me going through her bins. So she created a separate bin for me. So when I visited, there was like my bin and her bin. Because, I mean, she always threw away a lot of interesting stuff, you know, bottle tops, perfume bits, like little springs. And I just always used to just go and see what was there. I was quite introverted, but I quite like making my own little worlds. And I remember being on the swing one day and looking at my feet and just thinking they'd look so much prettier if I had sort of shoes with ribbons that wrapped up my legs. So I went into the house and sort of glue guns some foam together and stuck some ribbons on and made myself a pair of shoes with a tiny heel, which I thought was very elegant, and it was lovely. And I remember taking it to go to the supermarket with my mum, complete with like faux flowers and a shawl. I must add, I was quite young, but then being incredibly disappointed that of course the foam on the heel compressed really quickly, so my really elegant sort of dainty princess fairy shoes sort of became very flat and misshapen quite quickly. So then after that phase, I remember getting very into shoemaking and trying to work out how to make like the perfect non-compressible heel, and like adding bits of elastics in so my blood circulation didn't get too cut off with all the ribbons wrapped around. Yeah.
What strikes me about you as an artist or designer is that you often seem to start, not always, but often with illustration, like literally pen to paper. So for example, the signature of your dancewear and accessories line is that you've actually at one point hand illustrated the pattern.
Yes.
That then gets printed onto silk, etc. And for example, the costumes you made for the performance Makeshift did Insomniac's Fable, you actually ended up painting directly onto the costume as though the costume was a canvas. Mm. So I wondered whether drawing is your favored way in to a project.
I think a lot of my work is fairly rooted in sort of my childhood processes. I've always been very keen on bringing drawings to life, or like bringing things off the paper. I quite like sort of the magic involved in turning, mm-hmm. you know, I remember watching cartoons where the little illustration became sort of real and animated. So I think that's always enchanted me. And perhaps that's where sort of the very obvious illustrative part of my design work comes from. I think the other reason I do it, and probably the reason I would have given you first, is that I'm always quite keen in the whole process of creation. And mm-hmm. I felt that illustrating on pieces or translating a two-dimensional illustration to a 3D piece was something that was very much my signature and therefore something that I should do.
Do you keep a scrapbook of drawings? Because I always think of my, I don't use as fancy equipment as you use for photography. I use, well, frankly, I use my mobile phone, though they are getting fancier and fancier all the time. And I always think that my like pictures collection on my phone in a way acts as a journal and a scrapbook.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Well, I used to, like in the olden days before phones, and I was really late to getting sort of a modern phone with a camera and stuff. So until about 10 years ago, I was scrapbooking and kind of making my own collages and collecting postcards and general pieces. But now I'm very much of this generation. I think I just photograph everything. I photograph quotes, I photograph ideas, I photograph little pieces of interesting bent wood. And I don't tend to pick things up anymore like I used to. I still have quite a lot of random stuff sort of in my studio, but much less than I did before.
So we're recording this in January 2021, the year when everything was going to get better, but we're still waiting for that. I was joking with a colleague that we're going to see, like post-COVID, loads of theater pieces that are about, you know, a virus or a virus as a metaphor, that kind of thing. But you've been influenced by a less obvious, let's say, theme of the pandemic, which is touch or skin hunger. And you sent me a small article from a medical journal about it. So gentle touch releases oxytocin, the antidepressant serotonin, and the pleasure chemical dopamine. It reduces stress hormones as well. So this is like a real area of study, and they know what nerve receptors are specifically there to recognize gentle touch and all sorts of fascinating things, which are obviously coming to the fore right now because of where we're at. So tell me a little bit about what drew you to this topic.
Yes, so I was particularly fascinated when I learned about skin hunger because it described something that I think probably as artists and dancers we often have inbuilt into the intentions of our movements. And it was particularly interesting because I'd just come back from Harvard Art Lab where I'd been choreographing a human and a robot duet and the interaction between the two of them. And I'd come to the conclusion that the human dancer was craving that touch, and the robot was trying, or she had tried to get the robot to mimic another human, and it was really that sense of touch and longing that was underpinning the duet. So it was fascinating to learn there was a real term for that, because up until now I think I could have probably only danced the term.
Tell me a little bit about the piece you just mentioned with a robot and a dancer.
Yeah, so that was a research project that I collaborated on with my friend Merritt Moore, who's a physicist and a professional ballet dancer. And initially she invited me, or rather challenged me, to join her on a personal project because she'd always had this idea of dancing with a robot. And it was a two-person job, and she thought that creatively and artistically I could contribute. So I joined her in Oslo, and I was essentially choreographing her and the robot to dance together. So I was choreographing her in the standard sense, talking to her, and then, of course, going and programming the robot. And it was quite complicated because one partner, the robot, was really inorganic, and obviously time and cadence couldn't be altered without going into the program and then manually revisiting these numeric waypoints and altering the blend. And then the other was Merritt, a human. He was very organic, and she was nuanced and expressive, and she was much harder to predict whether she was marking in her socks or dancing full out on the tips of her pointe shoes. But actually it was at this point that I got really excited about the project and all the ideas surrounding human-robot engagement. From my reading, there seemed to be a necessary call for everyone to assert themselves over tech. And so I decided to make a really harmonious and gentle and symbiotic duet that was perhaps even emotional. And something, yeah, a dance piece that would hint at a more positive future for us with our relation to robots. It became such an interesting idea that we felt it had so much relevancy that we put out feelers for further development. And then after a few months, we were invited to go to Harvard's newly opened art lab, which was amazing. And at art lab, I choreographed the piece that I'd been imagining and became even more interested in the presentation.
Can you just describe for us how big it is and how it would physically interact with a dancer?
Yes. Yeah, so the robot itself wasn't humanoid, although it was essentially a jointed worm, which in a sense made it much less intimidating to work with, because for me it was quite like an articulated sculpture. So it was just one arm, but it's scale wise it was about the same as the dancer's Merritt's thigh, so it sort of could envelop her and react with her proportionately in a sort of more of a human way. Actually, I choreographed it to behave very lyrically, and I really wanted to challenge myself to make it emotive and make a very emotive duet. With its size and scale, I feel like it was like an arm or a hand. It sort of touched her and rebounded and, yeah, enveloped her.
It's funny that you described it as an animated sculpture, because I think that could also describe dance.
Actually, yes.
It is moving sculpture. So it sounds like you found a fairly harmonious relationship between a person and technology. And I wondered, what is that an area that interests you? And if you have any other examples of that?
Yeah, it was one of the things that interested me most about working with the robot. Firstly, because till the point of the challenge, I didn't think I was that interested in robots or tech. And doing this project has proved the contrary true. I'm now incredibly interested because it is vital that we are engaged. And that leads me to your question about like a harmonious relationship with tech. And I feel like the moment everybody engages with technology and we register that it's ultimately created in our form, you know, we have created it and it adapts and responds to our behavior, then I feel we could have more of a harmonious relationship with it. I feel like the moment we realize how prevalent and present technology and robots are in our lives, we might respond differently to sort of the information that an algorithm gives us on Instagram or the way we consume our media or news, knowing that actually this has come from robots that were created in our form. So, you know, we should go back to the source point and say, let's create them in a new way, or let's engage with the form in a different way, I think.
Throughout all this, all these lovely projects, up until recently, you've had what I call a parallel career as a classical ballet dancer. So you were in some really, really big companies. Most recently, Staatsoper Ballet in Berlin, which is a very large company. And I just wanted to touch on something I spoke about with Zoe Ash Brown in season one of this podcast, which is, as ballet dancers, particularly in a corps de ballet, how do you maintain or even find a creative voice? Because, you know, the paradox is that as a dancer, you're an artist, and what might draw you to being an artist is self-expression. But in the corps de ballet, which is like literally translates as the body of the ballet, you know, you're one of many. You're expected to stay in line, and you're expected to mimic the musicality of the people around you and literally make the same shapes with your body as everyone else. So for you, who is someone who is, you know, has such a broad range of interests and is so creative, how was your creativity affected in a company like that, where you really don't have a lot of spare time? You are working 6 days a week, You know, your days are really dictated by the schedule that someone else has made. You don't have a lot of creative agency in a big ballet company if you're in the court of ballet.
Mm. Well, I would say that most of my ballet career, not accidental or unintentional, probably unexpected, as in I started training very late at 16. I ended up in incredibly elite institutions due to an amazing amount of hard work and kind of obsessive dedication, but I never kind of expected to end up in those places. For me, it was always the journey to them that was interesting. So when I arrived, this is a roundabout way of saying when I arrived, I was a bit shocked really, because I hadn't ever expected to become a dancer. It kind of felt like a necessarily part of my emotional or artistic evolution that I had to. I couldn't imagine any other route than trying. But to actually be one, I hadn't really prepared for. I think it means that I look back and I definitely didn't push as much as I should have done, and like I did in other areas of my life. And I spent most of my time kind of as an observer and was so intrigued by these institutions that I hadn't been a part of, and I was kind of always a bit different too. I just found it very fascinating from that perspective to kind of suddenly be part of this elitist mass that I wasn't really trained for or kind of born, not born into, but it just wasn't from that background. So creatively, I don't think I was creative, and I definitely found that incredibly frustrating. And that is the reason I left. I still love dancing and I'm still young enough to be a dancer, but creatively it was, and intellectually it just wasn't as broad as I wanted it to be. And it didn't give me any, it just wasn't satisfying. So I tried to be creative, as in I think I was therapeutically creative. I made stuff to keep myself sane and to entertain other people, but I don't think I was challenging myself creatively. I mean, it's hard, like you say. I was in the core, so I was very junior. I love moving, and actually I often think it's quite strange I didn't get more into choreography and costume, but I didn't have, there wasn't space for me, like the sort of the senior members of the pyramid would sort of trample over and be like, oh no, not studio space, et cetera, et cetera. So my creative outlets are very small, like literally very small. And I made, like, for example, I used to make tiny miniature caricatures of mice that were, their feet were like the scrapes of leather that I would cut off my point shoes to make them silent. And I made all these miniature mice and silly little things I could sew in the corner of the room whilst wearing my tutu, and staff would think I was sewing my shoes or doing something very industrious. But instead I would be like making a family of mice that I would then like parade around quietly in the corner. But that was quite fun, because that led to me being a toy designer, which is another tangent. That was quite good.
Yeah, this is when you worked for Jellycat. And if you've got a child and you live in the UK, you know that literally 95% of the toys you pick up are Jellycat toys. Just briefly tell me what you did for Jellycat.
Well, I don't know if legally I'm allowed to talk about it. Like, I always talk about working for the big toy company, but whatever. They won't listen to this. Yeah, I worked for Jellycat for 5 years as a freelance designer. And actually the toys are all over the world. It's kind of one of my only things I've ever created where there's been a legitimately like good legacy of creation, as in I see them everywhere. I see them at the MoMA, I see them at the Paris Opera, my friends in Australia buy them for their babies. But essentially I just worked as a designer, so I come up with illustrations, sometimes I come up with like structural ideas and create soft toys.
As you do. Okay, so we haven't actually mentioned Designed by Alice yet by name, which is it's the name of your, for lack of a better word, your brand. It is many, many things, and probably increasingly is many, many things. Tell me a little bit about what led you to start it and what it meant to you.
Well, Designed by Alice was initially, it was kind of a survival project, as in I found myself having a private operation on my ankle post only 1 year of working professionally in a ballet company. I was freelance and I was out of, well, I wasn't freelance then. I was unemployed, wasn't sure what I was doing. And interestingly, because I had done costume design at ballet school, actually, along with dancing, and made stuff in my first company at Northern Ballet for lots of the dancers, I decided rather than working in a bar, I would create my own job that would be more flexible. And I started making dance wear and ballet skirts for my colleagues, ex-colleagues. And it proved quite popular, perhaps because people wanted something fresher. Back then, it was basically uniform or inherited beauties from sort of retired principals, and that's all people could choose between. So if you didn't have a wonderful dancewear collection to inherit, you were kind of stuck with sort of black velvet, you know, those cameo black velvet tops and kind of bit synthetic bottoms. So I'm not answering this very well, but I guess there was a need. I started making ballet skirts. I put quite a lot of effort into it. I actually did some of my testing at the Royal Opera House within their costume department whilst I was guesting with the Royal Opera. And I created quite a good product that's still going 10 years later. And even though I have considered a couple of times sort of pausing it whilst I was sort of pursued a more artistic career, either as a dancer or a designer, I am eternally grateful for sort of the residual income that it brings. And it has kind of been a backbone of purpose throughout what could have been a much more volatile and sort of abstract professional route, yeah. I guess. Yeah.
Part of the ethos of the Design by Alice range, particularly your new leotards, is a more thoughtful approach to dancewear and the making of it. But before you tell me about that specifically, can you tell me what is sometimes not thoughtful about dancewear?
Yes, I use thoughtful and acknowledgement that no process is perfect yet. And the moment you use the word sustainable, you're opening up a whole can of worms for discussion. And I also use it to show that despite all of this, I've considered and made thoughtful, balanced and informed choices about my production. There are a fair few dancewear companies actually created by dancers who are working towards a more holistic and thoughtful production process. But still, it's really frustrating to see the greenwashing trend. And by that, I mean like people marketing a product as green based on perhaps only one facet of that product's production. And as a consumer, it obviously makes it really hard to differentiate between genuinely sort of holistically conceived products and ones that are marketed as green and not. And I really think it's sort of sustainable closed loop system should be the given this day and age anyway, with the climate crisis and all we know about it. The most important points that I think to look for would be avoid supporting companies who rely on cheap production and manufacturing. And of course, consider the humans who make it and question why the prices are low. I'd also avoid people who are using, well, let's maybe not avoid people, but I really find these marketing strategies that rely on using influencers to market products really frustrating. And they send the influencers all these quickly made pieces that, of course, the influencer posts about because it's beneficial for their personal brand. But it just seems to be supporting a throwaway fashion industry, and it's unlikely the influencers will use this much free stuff. I just think it's a terrible precedent to set. If you go back towards the product, what I think a thoughtful product should be, you've kind of got to consider every stage of the process. So three good examples would be, well, if you start with like the fabric and the dye, most fabrics are actually dyed in big dye baths, which means a huge amount of dye is thrown at the fabric, a little bit will stick and the residual dye will be then absorbed into the waterway system. It's often very toxic and often ends up in the oceans, which is not ideal. People like me who use digital printing are striving towards using as least toxic chemical as possible. So, for example, in a digital printing system, it's like a computer printer. So you're kind of printing straight on the garments. There's a lot less waste and it's a lot more economic. When I work, I actually literally just print the exact shape I want on my garment. But that's the advantage of being a designer. And the fabrics themselves really ought to be considered. I really like the gesture towards using dead stock fabrics, but that's not really solving the problem because you can always create more artificial dead stock. So I try my best to find recycled materials. And there's a really cool fabric, actually, that I've sourced for my bodysuit that's made from 78% recycled plastic bottles. There's another one that's made from 78% recycled netting that can be theoretically regenerated indefinitely. The final thing I'd say is quality. As I mentioned before, no system is yet perfect, so buying less really makes a positive impact. So like, I always strive to make something that's really beautiful that you only need to buy one of, and ideally it will last the dancer's lifetime and could be passed on to the next generation too. And it's a kind of terrible business plan, but really that's what I think is the right thing to do and what people should strive for. So yeah.
Tell me about the pros and cons of being a multidisciplinary artist. In the States, they would call you a multi-hyphenate. It's very difficult to categorize you. We had an earlier discussion about what I should call you. Like, are you a designer? Or are you an art director? Are you an artist? Like, if I had to put a label on you, as I do when I write the show notes for the podcast. Yes, tell me about the pros and cons.
Maybe I'm too strong-willed or too much myself, as in I've always been drawn to where things merge, as in the unknowns. So the spaces in between two things to kind of explore and see what they are. That's the thing that excites me the most out of anything. And I guess that's the most creative place, because it's the place of the unexpected. That is a problem, because the thing that inspires me most is not being labelled and therefore being multidisciplinary. And if you go back to the multi-hyphened disciplinary sort of title, the title itself is fairly problematic, especially for promotion or promoting myself. It's hard because people want to remember you in a second and think, oh, this is the perfect person for this, or it's the perfect person for that. And even though I feel my breadth of range makes me a really useful person on any project, or actually to direct any solution and a really valued contributing player. I've got quite a lot of answers to this, actually, because I'd like to say multidisciplinary, sort of put it against the algorithm and say it's really hard when we're responsible for our own self-promotion to promote something that is perceived as promote ourselves in an authentic way on Instagram, for example, and not be perceived as confused, just because most people are used to seeing such a sort of direct and two-dimensional version of a person online. If a multidisciplinary person wants to go online, which they kind of have to make any money, they do look kind of a bit odd sometimes when you match them against everyone else who's continually posting the same photos, even though I think it's more interesting. So that's difficult. I think in real life, it's brilliant. Like, I love it. Like, it's so inspiring. If I'm not interested in something, I can bounce off onto somewhere else. Like, I'm always moving and I'm always interested. And that is such a gift and a general, like, joy to just love buzzing between sections. But yeah, it's really annoying for, like, commercial work. People just want to label you. And I thought, oh no, I don't need to be labelled. But then I come back to being the fact, yeah, I do need to be labelled. Like, people aren't aware of your ability or your thoughts. You can just look confused. It's quite easy to be perceived as a confused person rather than somebody that's actually just highly interested in quite a lot of things.
It's a lot easier when people at the dinner party, and what do you do? You just say, oh, I'm a ballerina.
Oh, those were the days.
Not only is that the end of that question, it's the beginning of lots of questions. Whereas I find myself now saying, like, I want to say, like, I do a bit of this, a bit of that, a bit of this. And I just end up saying, like, I used to dance, but now I teach Pilates.
And that seems such an unfair representation. And I totally empathize, because I too, like, in the past, I would say I'm a ballerina, and inside I would feel really sad because I knew the beauty of my title didn't really match my experience. So that made me feel very sad, because there would be a lot of wonder and respect and a lot of intrigue, a lot of excitement about the job title ballerina. But inside I felt really disappointed by the industry. Nowadays, I'm really excited about everything that I'm doing. I think it's brilliant. I'm super inspired. I've never been happier in myself or with my output. But I just can't, when anyone asks me what I'm doing, yeah, I just, I just don't know. I'm like, well, I used to be a ballerina. Now I do things. Sometimes robot, sometimes drawing. I have a business I offer up at some point to try and look a little bit more formal. I say, but I am, you know, not just playing with robots. I also contribute and pay my taxes.
So the first question is, was there a piece of art that changed everything for you?
Okay, so I'm going to say no to that, conversely. I often feel a bit embarrassed that I don't have, like, particular pieces of artwork or incredibly inspiring role models or visionaries that I know an awful lot about. I tend to just sample information, I think, and then be more inspired by the amalgamation of things in the moment rather than necessarily. I don't remember an epiphany moment in that sense with any piece.
Oh, I like the answer. This next one might be hard then. Can you think of a piece of art, and it could be anything, like music, an exhibit, a film, a dance, anything that you didn't necessarily love or even like, but that you think still has value?
The most interesting recent example I have of having heavily conceived something that I didn't like but I adored was Barbican's On Being Human exhibit about AI. And it started off incredibly engagingly, talking about sort of Shinto religion and the idea of objects having life and the essence of feeling, and sort of Jewish golems and bringing golems and little clay figures to life, something that's very sort of human. And it progressed to learning about how monitored we are and how much power so few people hold, and yeah, sort of the terrifying nature of the trajectory of this incredibly fast evolution of tech in basically the last century has happened. And I left feeling physically sick. But it was that exhibition that made me take on the challenge to work on the robot project set by my friend Merritt. And now I would say I read books on range and creativity, on AI and creativity. I read books on robots all the time now. And I... it was a real sort of turning point in my engagement with the subject. But I left feeling sick, probably for a couple of days, like really sort of sweaty and just horrid.
You were worried about the direction the potential was headed.
I'm really worried about all of it, like I am probably with the environmental stuff too, which is why I feel it's so important to mesh and engage, have a meshed approach to how we take things forward.
Last question is there an artist you'd like to nominate the listeners to check out who they may not know about?
So I'm currently reading Neri Oxman's book from her exhibit that could have been open to the public at the moment, but wasn't. And in a very sort of COVID-19 way, I bought the exhibition book rather than going to the exhibition. Neri's work fascinates me because she's very multi-hyphenated. Obviously incredibly charismatic and successful, but is really owning her multifaceted approach to research and production. She's very aesthetically orientated, but it's really grounded in science, and she's working with nature to create new technologies that are both practical and then aesthetically pleasing. Everything from encouraging silkworms to make continuous thread and working these special contractions so you don't have to boil them afterwards when you're making materials out of silk. I mean, an incredible plethora of stuff, and her lab is super cool. And I just think she's a very cool example of how you can mesh design, tech, science with new ways of thinking and new ways of producing. So everyone should check her out. And I actually didn't find her in any like particularly special way. I was just on Netflix's Abstract series as recommended by you, Emma. And I saw her and I was just so excited. And and I've geeked out on her ever since.
To see examples of some of Alice's work and some of her beautiful images and photography, go to her website, designedbyalice.co.uk, also her Instagram, designedbyalice. Links will be in the show notes. And that brings us to the end of season 2 of Movers, Shakers, Makers, which has included our first ever mini-series, Ballet for the 21st Century. Thank you to all my new listeners who've joined me this season, and of course, thank you to all my listeners who've been with me from the very beginning. I'll be taking a short break now, but I'll be back before you know it. Stay safe. Okay, closing credits. This season of Movers, Shakers, Makers is supported by the Norfolk Arts Project Fund and using public funding by the National Lottery through the Arts Council England. It has also been a Makeshift Company production. Follow us on Instagram at Makeshift Company and check out our website, makeshiftcompany.com, where there is a link to the podcast website for show notes. Please subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Also, if you rate and review the show, it would be most appreciated. Thanks for listening. And now, from the cutting room floor, I give you...
Now, I saw my ballerinas in the Opera Garnier gift shop. I've seen my work in the MoMA. I've seen my work in the Tate. I've actually been in every major gallery. So now I'm like, well, maybe I don't have to try anymore. That's it.